So the apparent issue, and I mean apparent because the word apparent refers to the fact that life is an appearance, meaning it's an unfolding process of transiency until it's seen that that isn't all it is. The only way to see, realize that that's not all it is to see through conditioning. So I want to talk a bit about conditioning tonight. What it is, how it operates, and its gift. If there's a question or something that arises that you want to speak out, feel free to do it. If I'm in the middle of talking and it comes, just go like this. If I'm not talking, just don't go like this. Just say it. Conditioning appears to be the issue. Conditioning, when I talk about conditioning, I mean conditions of body, bodily discomforts, bodily symptoms, disease, conditions of mind, mind states, emotional states that seem difficult, situations, dynamics in the world that we perceive to be difficult, unfair, unjust, unkind, cruel, conditions, situations. And when we're contemplative, when we're non-judgmental enough to begin to look at these conditions, however they're manifesting, we can begin to see something that they're offering that initially we might not see. When we don't see what conditions are offering, we are to some extent vulnerable to being caught in conditions. And those conditions roll us around, so to speak. We're caught up in dot, 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 whatever it is. We absorbed for moments or longer in thought processes, mood states, which is like a mood state is like a, often a combination of emotion and sensation and mentation or thought forms that generate a, let's just use the image or the metaphor of a cloud. You feel as if you're in a cloud, a blue mood, a dark mood. I'm in a light mood, I feel light, playful. Look honestly, you can see that moods are conditioned. Everything that appears is conditioned. This is the wonderful gift of the Buddhist teachings, not just the Buddha, but teachings of truth. The Buddha just gave his version very clearly. Everything is dependent on something else. It's called dependent origination. It's the root of what karma actually is. And it's a fact of existence. It describes how conditions are unfolding, interrelated with other conditions. Nothing arises independently. Nothing arises separate from other conditions. Ah, yes, you start to see this. And whatever the symptom or condition might be, whatever the situation might be, perspective opens and allows us to realize that situation, event, circumstance, is in context with other things. If we don't see this, then we tend to feel or perceive the symptom or condition as isolated, contracted away from things. This is an illusion. I'm not saying it doesn't arise. At times it does. Illusion itself is a condition. Confusion is a condition. Clarity is a condition. Just notice the condition of preference that would prefer clarity over confusion. Preferring clarity over confusion actually, strangely, ironically, feeds confusion. Seeing, meaning realizing, here's the condition of preference. Preference for pleasant sensations. What human being doesn't have some degree of preference for pleasant experiences over unpleasant experiences? Even a sadomasochist has strangely confused pain with pleasure and seeks those intense experiences and the strange pleasure inside the pain. Recognizing or seeing conditioning offers the possibility of beginning to see through conditioning, or to see, as I would put it, the gift of conditioning. And that is part of the gift of being a human being. What's strange is that in being born a human being, and looking around at other human beings, one easily takes being a human being for granted. You don't have to believe or even consider any notions of reincarnation and rebirth, but just say you did, and you analyze, you look at a situation and you look at a being who has much less opportunity than oneself. It could be another human being, or it could be a stray cat. And you watch the cat a little bit and you see the cat seems terrified, uneasy. I was driving through Bronson over the weekend. I went kayaking out at Cedar Key and almost roasted. Just almost, because the breeze was blowing just enough so that it wasn't too hot. I was a little bit apprehensive about my wife's suggestion that we go kayaking on the 4th of July. But I sucked it up and said, okay, let's do it. On the way back, there was an accident. As we approached the scene of the accident, there was a mangled bicycle. And I mean mangled. And the thought arose, oh, looks like someone didn't make it. Sure enough, the story learned later. A set of conditions unfolded. Someone drifted across the lane. Boom, hit the bicyclist. Boom, done. Change. What's done? A life as we know it is over. A bicycle's mangled. This ephemeral condition of body-mind, the strangeness of the apparent life, hides, oh, so sublimely, a pearl beyond price. It generally doesn't appear unless a human being is contemplative, earnest, interested in seeing through conditions. And I mean conditions like death. I mean conditions like disease that doesn't let up. I mean conditions of, let's take the example of having a child that's disabled or handicapped and is not going to develop out of that condition. Do you surrender? Do you run away? Do you embrace it all the more with love and appreciation? We see human beings doing all of these things. Your reactions are conditions, but so are your responses. Your attitude, your values are conditioned. The only thing that isn't conditioned, and it's not a thing, is that which is looking at the conditions. That which is hiding inside the vision that your eyes provide. The wonder of hearing that your ears offer. The immensity and power of feeling that the body provides. Hiding until it isn't inside those conditions is that which is observing. Not an observer, because there is no observer. Not a witness, because there is no witness. There is witnessing, there is observing, there is awareness. There is seeing, recognizing, abiding as that which isn't a condition. And it's the same for all of us. It is utterly and completely personal and impersonal simultaneously. When I say impersonal, I don't mean it all in the pejorative or negative. Transpersonal might be a better word. It transcends the perception of personal apart from other personal. And so each of us has a unique set, you might say, of conditions. And if we're not careful, those conditions become patterns, become habituated. And this we see over and over and over in our mind. If we look at it and we're honest, we don't run away, we don't distract. Because you can run through a life, you can distract through a life, you can go the whole way and never really stop and look. Or you can do a partial look, a sidelong glance. Don't really want to stop and look at that restlessness, that uneasiness, that uncertainty, that doubt, that relentless wanting, that unsatisfactoriness. Looking for something better someplace else. Hoping it exists. Believing in its myth. Finding evidence to support the myth. Yes, it's better somewhere else. There's a feeling that's better than the one I have. There was a period in my life that was better than this one. I'm going through a hard time. Yes, you might be going through a hard time. Inside all of these conditions, there's the primary, fundamental condition. And let's look at that. There is no spiritual seeking without this condition that I'm going to mention. There is no meditation. There is no path. It's the condition of the seeker. This energy of the seeker arises unconsciously at a time when we're so innocent. It's rare that human beings see this upon arising. It's the first moment of separation. science actually is getting closer to an analysis of it. Somewhere between birth and 18 months, the young child has an experience of self and other. The subject-object dichotomy appears. Quite simply, you might say naturally, you might even say by necessity. It's not there in the womb. There's no self and other. This has been proven by those who actually do a form of therapy and go back inside the experiences of being in utero. You can do that. You don't have to take drugs. You can do holotropic breath work and go back inside and remember your birth and what happened before. It's there. It's accessible. Birth is a weird, interesting, sometimes very traumatic, sometimes not, experience for humans. Then out of the chute, cut the cord, gotta breathe here, gotta eat here now. Doesn't mean separation's arisen yet. Hopefully fed well, picked up when needed, allowed to rest, provided with comfort. It's never perfect. Just enough, though, so you don't get too crazy too fast. That comes later. 2 varying degrees. The nature of the unfolding reality of conditions indicates, requires that the sense of separation occurs. Self and other appears. Prior to that, it's just pure, undifferentiated being, unified, undifferentiated. Look in a baby's eyes that hasn't entered separation yet, and you won't see fear. You might see innocent wonder. Don't conceptualize it, turn it into a story, or say how cute Samantha is, or Barney, whatever his name might be. Just see it, because you're looking at yourself. Once the sense of separation appears, there's 2 things that then happen. 2 varying degrees for almost everyone. Bewilderment arises. Some degree of uneasiness in the form of bewilderment. And with that bewilderment, seeking arises. Seeking to not be separate. To not be apart. To not be other. But you can't go back. You can't go back and do one of those things that the comedians do sometimes. I remember Robin Williams did it so well once when he was younger. They had him on a thing roasting somebody. He was one of the panelists roasting, can't remember his name. The guy who used too much cocaine. What was his name?
Richard Pryor.
Yeah, thank you. They're roasting Richard Pryor, and Robin Williams said something that was goofy, and then he went, like a tippy corner, but just pulled it back in. You can do that. Even though you can go back in and you can experience your memories, what happened before, you can't play a tape recorder and reverse what's happened. What's happened has already happened. It's done. Ultimately, all you can do is go forward. Actually, ultimately, all you can do is go in and out and in and out and in and out until you begin to see at the point of separation is the jump starter for your path of insight. This would not be very interesting. This realm would not be very interesting if everybody was simply resting permanently in conflict-free existence. The other way to say it is this would be a really different place. I use the word interesting because I don't know what your word is for what's going on. Particularly when it's time for an election in this country. I mean, it's profoundly interesting when women are breaking through the riot lines in Venezuela just to get food right now. It's out of control. And the British pound sinks like a rock while the dollar goes up. It won't be long before it flips. It's all conditions. It looks like an unfortunate circumstance to be feeling yourself as bereft in separateness, vulnerable to aloneness, loneliness, and all the states that can cycle around that. But really, it's the gift in disguise. It's the propulsion. Conditioning is the fuel that helps you look, gets your attention, wakes you up, asks you, strangely, non-verbally, asks you, who are you? What are you? And you know you can't answer that with your brain. You can't give an adequate answer with words. All you can do is look into the nature of what's happening, into conditions themselves, patiently, hopefully with enough support from people who care about similar things. Once you get established enough in the sense of what it means to abide in observation, then it's wonderful to be completely alone. You start to feel like you don't need anybody. Doesn't mean you don't want and enjoy people, but you don't need anybody. You're okay. Okayness. Deep okayness. See, the baby's deeply okay, but doesn't recognize that. The baby's deeply abiding as it is in true nature, doesn't recognize it. Why do we need the journey? 60, 70, 80 years. Some people only need 30 or 40. That's all they get. But they're clear about these things because they've worked out, worked through conditioning. And you look at humans and you can see some people have a lot more heavy conditioning. Oh my goodness. I have a sister, for example. She's now at a point in her life where she has a kind of osteoporosis where if she just falls down a little bit, she breaks a bone. So she just fell the other day and shattered her arm and had to have an operation that lasted 2 hours long. And has to be on heavy narcotics. And the last time she fell, she broke the other arm. And the time before that she fell, she broke her ankle. She commented in the text, I think I'm ungrounded. That's a condition. That's a perception. That's a view. Then she went on to say, I've been doing some shamanic soul retrieval. And it's been indicated to me that parts of my soul are lost and can't come back because I'm not grounded. She's very vulnerable to believing what people tell her. And so I'm very careful because she trusts me sometimes. to not give opinions, and to not give philosophy, to not give ideas, to not give diagnosis. Because if she's vulnerable, she'll latch onto it. This is a human being. When her father was in the last few days of his life, in the very house where he was going to breathe his last, she stole his medications, his morphine and his lorazepam, and was going to take her life. She was going to commit suicide 2 days before her father died in the same house. How do I know this? Because I was right there. I was in the same house. That's a powerful set of conditions. Powerful desire, powerful fear, powerful aversion to suffering, powerful confusion. That's not clarity. She had no clarity. Her birth brother, my birth brother, found her with the medications and physically took them away from her. And then she came running to me like a child crying. I'm so sorry. It's tragic. If you knew her as I know her, you'd say this is a beautiful human being. She's innocent, she's bright, she's educated. She's had such a difficult life. Major treatment-resistant depression. That's the kind of depression that doesn't resolve when you take the most powerful medications available. That's the type of medication, that's the type of condition that doesn't tend to evolve even when you get ECT. You know what that is? That's sophisticated present-time shock therapy. Not the ideal thing for the brain. Not so good. Nice to avoid. But if you're so depressed that you can't get out of it, guess what? That works sometimes. Changes the chemistry. Burns out part of the memory. I only mention her because she's so close. She's come out of the same womb as me. And my condition. Yeah. I know what it's like to get depressed, not like that. I know what it's like to break a bone. But I don't know what it's like to feel like my skeleton is so fragile. But the last 3 times that I fell down, I broke my bones in major ways. She just fell down in the yard. Was there a rock? I don't know. Not even on the pavement. It evokes feelings. Sometimes we feel a little happier when we look at the conditions of others and we go. Sometimes we feel very, very sad to see the conditions of others. Sometimes we feel, how come it's so good for you? How come it works out for you? You ever not want to call somebody? Because you think they're going to tell you just all good news. It's a strange moment. Wow, really? That happened and that happened and that happened? And all I got is a tummy ache? Still struggling with my sleep? You got it so easy? No, you don't got it so easy. We're all equal. We're right there on the same plane as those Venezuelan women fighting for food. Those conditions that they're experiencing, they're right here inside us. They might just be acting them out. What happens as you begin to wake up is you see for sure you're no better or worse off than anybody. That whole hierarchy, higher, lower, better, worse, goes pop. It's justice, finally. It's equality. Oscar Pistorius gets 6 years for killing his girlfriend. They reduced it to manslaughter instead of murder. Took off his false legs, walked through the courtroom with something about as long as a thigh, shaking, afraid, pleading for community service instead of a jail sentence. Analyze how they actually came up with the sentence. It's actually clear the way they worked the case. It took a long time. You know this guy, right? He's the guy that put on the blades and ran in the Olympics. His life is ruined. He ruined the lives of his girlfriend's family. They're all shattered. What's interesting is, why put this man in jail for 15 years if he's really honest and seeking forgiveness, if he really, truly understands his mistake? There's so many angles you could look at it from. And all those angles are conditions. You see, your view is conditioned by your beliefs, by your opinions. But the good news is, it doesn't have to be. When your view clarifies into correct view or true view, you can look at any opinion, you can look at any position, you can look at any situation with interest and curiosity. You can look at the Holocaust and go, you can look at slavery. You can look at the whole dynamic of Orlando and the killing. You can look at it and not flinch. You can look at those powerful, most powerful conditions and go, what is there to see here? What is there to learn? And this is just how you look at the world around you, the day-to-day stuff. Now, what about the so-called internal? Something about just simply learning to sit still and be awake, not sleepy, not wandering, attentive, curious, interested, available, and resting. That's where peace of mind comes from, is resting amidst the conditions that are unfolding. That's where heart opens up, feels loving, interest, and compassion. When human beings are resting amidst conditions and not driven towards or away from those conditions too much. Doesn't mean you shouldn't have opinions. Doesn't mean you shouldn't have ideas or positions that you take. It just means you don't take them so seriously, don't take them so firmly, that it closes out other possibilities. It's also how you experience and can experience a happiness that isn't dependent so much on conditions. Call it a joy if you'd like. A joy that isn't dependent on things being a certain way. Because observing itself becomes joyful. Watching closely. Simple things. Like birds, hearing them, seeing them. I have a friend who has a raccoon that comes in his backyard. He says, you know, I think I'm in love with the raccoon. I said, why? He said, because the raccoon goes and watches me. So I watch the raccoon. I think I love the raccoon. And he said it, he's like very childlike. He's like a 5-year-old. Love my teddy bear. This is a live raccoon that happens to be visiting his backyard for now. I had a squirrel named Buster. We called him Buster. He had no tail. He used to visit, I think, our house. I thought, you know, that's how the mind works sometimes. You think something really visits you more than other things because it keeps coming. It's like months Buster was there. He was a disabled gray squirrel. And if I ever saw him with another squirrel that was fully tailed, he would like, and they had a little thing, Buster would like overcome the situation. He would like seem like he was a tough guy. And then one day Buster was gone. He died. He found some other place to go. Boom. Disappearance. It's life. Boom. Change. Whether you like it or not. There's a condition. You liked it, you didn't like it. You preferred this, you didn't prefer that. It's not wrong to have those things. It's not wrong to experience attachment. It just hurts. It's not wrong to experience aversion. It's not wrong to hate a politician. It's something that your mind does. So instead of trying to get out of, to escape, to avoid, instead of believing in a freedom from, you begin to realize the only freedom is freedom amidst. Only freedom is freedom amidst. That even if you found a way to cloister yourself and took away all the stimulation that you didn't want to have, you would still deal with this internal weather, this internal chemistry. You would still deal with the conditions of mind. And in fact, they might intensify. Thomas Merton, wonderful contemplative, wrote beautiful, beautiful things about, for his language, religious life. And then spontaneously electrocuted by a simple desk lamp. Deez boom. So tragic. How'd that happen? Why'd that happen? It did happen. A minute, so-and-so is walking along just fine. The next minute, there's a feeling. The next minute, there's a lump. The next minute, there's a cancer. The next minute, it's stage four. Next month, gone. We're this close. Somebody said the other day, it was so wonderful. They were talking about food and talking about the hurricane in New Orleans, Katrina. The person gave a little mathematical thing, I think they're an ecologist of some kind. They said, we're all 9 meals away from chaos. Just 9 meals. I don't know how they came up with 9, but we're in this belt of relative comfort, temperature wise. It's so thin if you look at it. What are we going to do with this precious situation? While we have an opportunity to interface with it conscientiously, you could say ethically, spiritually. And that's up to each of us. That's the strange additional gift of being a human. Get a body, you get a mind, you get a set of circumstances, set of conditions, certain amount of this or that kind of given to you. Maybe good health, good genes. Maybe not so good health, not so good genes. Certain amount of material. Certain amount of education. Certain amount of encouragement. Certain amount of, okay, you can be you. Certain amount of, okay, go ahead. You can fly. Okay, it's time to leave the nest. Go ahead. We're not going to keep you here. Go to the other side of the world if you want. Go. Or the opposite. Sometimes parents are like, don't move that far away. We stay close. You know, family laws are laws that unconsciously operate within family systems. This is the way we do things. Who do you think you are? Like, you're leaving the clan. codependence and enmeshment, a kind of addiction, attaching, living through other people. You know at least one person like this? You get too close and they try to live through you. Your boundaries. Time to go home. May your children benefit from your meditation.
Thank you.
And your hubby.
Night-night.
Thank you. So what are you thinking? What kind of condition of thought are you having? Anybody? You're just waving. See, that's a condition. I thought she was raising her hand and she was waving. See, you think it's this and it's that. So what about the conditions that you see in your life? What's going on there? What are they like for you?
But the condition of parenthood, I mean, I would consider it a good thing, but that having a child or children creates an earnestness or a sense of I need to get good at what I thought I was going to get good at, whether that's cultivating awareness or meditation or yoga or whatever. Are you able to kind of speak to that condition of parenthood, because there's a certain level of obligation of attachment, at least for a certain amount of years, how that sort of affects attachment, I guess.
Yeah, there's a whole I think I was in the either in the New Yorker or maybe in the Atlantic, there was this whole piece on attachment theory. And I didn't get into it in depth. I meant to. It was, didn't have time at that moment to go into it more deeply. But a tremendous amount of research going on about attachment theory and the necessity of appropriate bonding, which in some sense makes just common sense to some of us, you know, between parent and child. For that child to develop appropriately psychologically, emotionally, and become, you know, somewhat healthy and independent. Basis for health and good creative life, as opposed to codependency, enmeshment, attachments that don't foster independence. Even though there's truly no independence, all there is interdependence. But we can see a big difference between someone who hasn't been parented well, whose parents were neurotic, who were maybe so disturbed that they couldn't tolerate a child separating. You know, when a child first starts to separate and crawls away from mommy, he needs to go away and get over here and then get a little skin and run back and get in mommy's lap. Well, if mommy doesn't have an appropriate ground in her own psychology, she's disturbed when the child goes away, and then she rejects the child when the child comes back. That creates a borderline personality disorder if it goes on enough. And a borderline personality disorder is a human being who cannot tolerate intimacy and cannot live without it. It's an incredible double bind. It's one of the most fascinating and difficult psychological disorders to actually heal from. And a human being who has that kind of condition can be extremely intelligent, they can be extremely productive, but in relationships they're utterly and completely neurotic and almost psychotic. That's why they're called a borderline, because they're right in between neurosis and psychosis. Psychosis simply means that you're having perceptions that are very, very different than the rest of us. Like, we are not in a room right now and I am not talking. Okay? This is a hole in the ground, it's dark, and these are worms that are after me. You. Okay, paranoid view, right? Neurotic. A lot of emotional disturbance, a lot of thought disturbance, a lot of other kinds of symptoms, but you still got a perception that's close enough to what other people are perceiving that we're in a room, right? Good, okay, we're in a room. Walls are over there, yeah, ceiling, okay, yeah. goes like that, right? Fans. Okay. It's the floor, right? Okay, good. If you're called to do fathering, mothering, parenting, it's a powerful path that opens you. It shows you from the get-go the innocence and the potential of what you are. It like comes right out there before your eyes, super close. It's there like every day for you to see yourself in essential nature, and you participate in the mystery of that, the incredible mystery of life, that human beings are capable of doing that. And then the whole like task of like watching how the conditioning that you yourself are carrying can manifest in the parenting in ways where, I had a friend once who said, as long as I do it better than my dad did it, I'm doing okay. And I, when I heard that, I wasn't a parent yet, I heard that and I was like, oh, this is not going to work for me. I have to be a little bit more than just that, because there was a lot of stuff that Dad was not right about, as good as he was. You know, I got to shoot a little higher than that. But then when you look back, you see there's no perfect. It's learning. Perfect's an idea. It floats around. It's contrasted to that which happens sometimes. And it makes us crazy to hold on to that. But at the same time, it's worth shooting for the best you can do. And know that you're going to mess it up and learn from it. And so your children come, you know, they just come at you with the teachings. They just come at you with the innocence. They come at you with the development of the personality. They come at you with their uniqueness. They come at you with their sexuality. They come at you with, you know, everything that they're about will just show up and say, you appreciate this? You understand this? Can you see this? And it's right there. It's just amazing. It's not just the procreative drive that makes people do it. I mean, interesting, we're here in part because of this procreative drive. Imagine if what didn't feel like it does to have sex. You think there'd be so many of us floating around here? The whole thing would start to change fast. Imagine if it was painful all the time. Imagine if it felt like you were being tortured. You know, you think people would be popping out babies? No. It's interesting that it's designed like that. How'd that happen? Where'd that come from? So this is a deep thing that goes on around sexuality, and then out of that comes this procreative, and out of that comes this life, and out of that comes this teaching, and out of that comes these conditions. And as I was saying earlier, right there is that innocence of the nature of original being shining through that newborn, and then that newborn takes on its own unique set of conditions, and there's nothing that can stop it. And maybe this kid's going to become a drug addict. And maybe this kid's going to become the president. And maybe this kid's going to die before you do. You just don't know. You roll the dice. There was a whole lot that really could be said about it, because it's a whole part of the path that isn't really there in the Buddhist teachings, because the Buddha didn't have anything on developmental psychology. Nada. He's not a developmental psychologist. He didn't talk about family systems. He didn't talk about codependence. It wasn't part of the teaching. It was a contemplative flowchart. It showed the nature of existence and showed you how to awaken amidst it. Later on, we human beings go, you know what? Not all of us are going to be cloistered and living as monks and nuns and taking no money through a job, begging for our food. We're going to live in a city. We're going to live with a job. And we're going to, you know, have a livelihood. And we're going to have a creative life, a pursuit. It involves aspects of ourselves that are very different than what monks and nuns sometimes activate. I actually spent a lot of time with monks and nuns. There was a period of time when I found them utterly boring. I still loved them. They had nothing to say. Which is fine, if you're willing to be completely quiet. I'm not to put them down. I loved them. I just got tired of it after a while. Like when the monk was in the back of my car and I had my child and I was driving this crappy Volvo out by the mall one day and it was wicked hot. It was like today. It was that hot. And my daughter was in the back baby seat like screaming and I was caught in traffic. And I looked at the monk and I said, "Help." And he was clueless. He had no idea what to do. I said, "I'm going to pull the car over. You get in the back seat and soothe her, would you?" And he looked at me like I was nuts. And I looked at him like, "You're nuts." It was such an interesting set of conditions and moments. You know, it was wonderful. And I didn't love him any less. I just realized he had no idea how to do that. He had no experience of that. I learned later that he was a young boy. He was a monk. They put him in the monastery. They put him in the monastery in Sri Lanka. And he ran away. He ran away because he felt imprisoned. And putting conditions onto him at an early stage. He couldn't play, he couldn't run around, so he ran away and then they caught him. And they went and caught him and they brought him back and put him in the monastery again. And then he accepted it. Imagine that. And it's shipped away. This happens not in this country very much. Ship the kid away. Dalai Lama was taken as a boy. They came and found him. You know, they said, "You're the next Dalai Lama." His parents were crying and holding each other and going through, and they let him go. So he's going to go to the monastery and get this training as part of the tradition. You don't say no if they come and say, "Oh, the sorcerer and everybody says you're the Dalai Lama. You've got to go to the monastery and study the teachings, become a world teacher." So eventually let go, I guess, and feel wonderful about that opportunity for their child to be the Dalai Lama. But I also say, Eric, that, you know, it goes on and on, even when they leave. It just changes. You know, once you start that one, you're in it until you're not here. It just changes as far as I can see. Now, some people bail on it. I had a friend when I was in graduate school. He lived in the house below me in California. And he had two kids about the same age as my kids. And he said to me one day, it was so sad. He was a cook. He was a good cook. He was a chef, really. He was very skilled. He said, "I can't wait for my kids to be grown up and gone." And I looked at him and I said, "Why?" "Because they impose on me." "Ooh, really? Really?" I kept my noble silence. There was things I wanted to say, you know, I wanted to question him. See how vulnerable he was to this form of conditioning. Feeling that his freedom was imposed upon by the very children that he brought to this world. What a sad circumstance. Can't wait till they're grown and so I can do what? Stay out late and have a beer? What do you want to do, man? Where do you think you're going? What are you going to get someplace else? See, if we're not careful, one of the conditions that happens is we're really not present and we miss our life. And you look back and you go, "Oh, where was I? What was I doing? Oh, I was teaching meditation retreats while my wife was taking our children to her parents' house in Virginia where there was snow. You know what? I only got to be with my kids in the snow once. And then they weren't interested in being in the snow anymore with me. They were raised up." It's like, "Oh, you love meditation so much, you didn't quite balance that one, Paul. You can't do that over." So I'm looking at pictures of the kids playing with the snowman. And where am I? I'm in Florida teaching meditation. A little regret there, Paul? Yeah. Can't do it over. So it definitely gets your eyes open if you let it. Yeah.
I thought it was interesting that you were talking about small children as being pure awareness.
Yeah.
I was in a situation this weekend where it was a family reunion type situation.
Yeah.
And there was one, I would say toddler, probably like two. And everyone wanted to go hang out and spend time with the toddler. And I'm watching them spend time with the toddler. And it's like every person who came up and spent time with the toddler was projecting themselves onto the baby.
Isn't that interesting?
It was really kind of upsetting. But I think it was upsetting to me because I was at my fiance's family's deal, and I know these same people will be interacting with children of ours if we were to have children. But aside from that, it was an interesting experience to observe everyone interacting with this child and wanting to spend time with their own little.
Yeah, put their story, put their set of conditions on the child. And so then there's you watching this and then feeling some disturbance. So here comes the conditioned mind again, reacting to the conditions of these people, putting their conditions on this innocence, so to speak. They can't help it. How many people actually rest in what James Joyce, a great American writer, called aesthetic arrest when they look at a child, when they look at a painting? How many people drop out of desire, drop out of all the story, and just be? That's what true art is about. That's what the natural world is for. That's what a baby's for. That's what looking in another person's eyes is about. That's what love is. And love is both a story and not a story at the same time. There's the story of love, and then there's love that isn't a story. So there's both the innocence of that aware being that isn't a story, or that being of awareness, as you said very nicely. And then there's the innocence and the wonder and the power of the set of conditions, that story. And humans who wake up see the story for what it is and see beyond it. Humans who don't wake up, that's why the story is an appearance. The story is another word for a set of conditions. Humans who don't see this, they live as if the conditions are all there is. And they suffer by those conditions, and they feel happy amidst those conditions, and they go around within those conditions. And that's it, really, in simple terms. The difference between spiritual awakening and living life in an unawakened way. It's the difference between seeing the appearances of the story of the conditions for what they are or not. It's really that simple, in a way, to say. It's a bit more, you know, nuanced to actually realize. Come out of the story. And everybody comes out of the story. Like those people who are in their story, they also touch moments where they're not in the story. But those moments are often too subtle or sublime for them to be enunciated enough. What meditation does is it enunciates those moments of non-narrative, non-story, non-conditioned awareness. Because awareness isn't conditioned. It's the only thing, and it's not a thing, going on here that isn't conditioned. Everything else is conditioned. But as soon as you believe you are that awareness, and your thought, mind, brain latches onto that awareness as your awareness, now you're conditioning even that. And that's not wrong, and it's not right. It's just something that happens. And it's something that can be seen and observed. You see, the baby can't recognize in most cases what it is. It just is what it is. What the story and set of conditions do for us, if we let them do what they can do, right? If we open to them, if our yoga, our meditation, our discipline is to let these conditions open us, then what those conditions open us to is what we always already are. Hiding, until it isn't, inside the conditions. And this is what happens to people when they die well. Eric and I were talking about it on the way in. His dad came a few weeks ago, and I mentioned to Eric as we were coming in, I like your dad. And then he said a couple things about his dad, and he said, your dad reminds me of my dad. We were talking about disease a little bit, and as my dad got older, his spirit, so to speak, or his awareness, his being, his natural innocence, his wonder, just became more and more and more evident as his body fell apart. As the dementia set in, and he couldn't remember things, it didn't matter. The playfulness was there, the love got stronger and stronger and stronger. And then, that's how he went. And the body dropped. Now remember, like, 5 minutes, 10 minutes after his body dropped, it was like 8 at night. And for me, I have no idea whether this is actually the way it happened or whether it was my imagination, but it was a cold winter day in January in New England. The temperature was like 20 degrees and there was snow on the ground, and it was a clear night. The moon was bright and the clouds were whipping through the sky. And I was exhausted because I just spent almost a week not sleeping, just caring for him, being a part of that process, that visual, until he's gone. He said, please, son, don't put me in a nursing home. Let me die at home. Let me die with my family around me. And let me die with peace. When he told me these things, I said, I'm going to do everything I possibly can do to give him these four wishes. First three were relatively easy. The fourth one was like, I'm watching for your peace. I'm taking care of your peace as carefully as I can. And when my older sister came into the room with her big ego and started singing and dancing and making all kinds of noise, when we'd been meditating with Dad, I got reactive and I was like, stupid Melinda, that's her name. Stupid, I said, stupid Melinda. I ran out of the room, called my wife on the phone. I said, you won't believe what my sister just did. She comes in the room, she starts screaming and dancing and making it all about her. My wife said, calm down, Paul. Your father's so far beyond that. Get back in there. You've trained for your whole life to not be reactive. Don't let your sister throw you off. I said, I know why I married you. See you later. Oh, just because you see through reactivity doesn't mean it doesn't come back. And sometimes it comes back with a vengeance. As you become less defended, you see, like that baby, as you become less defended, then your conditioning sometimes will come with such potency. Because you're not defended. You're not holding it down. You're not pretending that everything's okay. You're not really even concerned so much about okay, not okay. You're more concerned about what is. What is the nature of what's happening here? Free from interpretation. You see, the baby is that, but the baby can't see that. And that's why it seems to me we need this journey of living in the conditions and even as the conditions. We need to get caught up in things to see it. We need to have that polarity, that friction, that dynamic, that self and other, that seeking. Because the seeker all the while doesn't know it, but the seeker is seeking its own dissolution. Because it's not until that seeking falls away that you begin to see who you are before seeking started. And that's the baby's innocence waking up again. You see it in people like the Dalai Lama. Thich Nhat Hanh, you can't see it in so much anymore because of his stroke. He's changed because of his stroke. But I remember being with Thich Nhat Hanh, great Buddhist monk. Very, very, very innocent, childlike, bright, intelligent. He's different now because the brain's not the same. The personality's there. See, personality's a condition. It's not who you are, it's just part of who you are. Ego structure is the condition. It's not who you are, it's just part of who you are. Just like your arm, okay? It's part of your body. It's not your whole body. Your body is part of who you are. It's not what you fundamentally are. It's a vehicle for you to see who you really are. It's a condition. The body-mind is a set of conditions. The science doesn't use this language. Psychology does, but science uses its own language, if you like, the world of science, because the science is getting closer and closer to this. Like they've looked at the brain close enough, you know, neurology of the brain. They can't. There's no I or self in there. There's no. It's just a thought that comes and goes. There actually, literally, is no individual. An individual is a perception. It's a condition born from the sense of separation. Prior to the sense of separation, there's no individual. There's no self and other. There's just beingness. If you look at a baby that's on the breast, and it hasn't gone into the sense of, because some kids are still on the breast at 4 years old, and they're fully like differentiated, and they still want a nurse. It's interesting. Not necessarily right or wrong. People have opinions about it. Some women let their babies nurse until they stop, and some women wean the kid off. I don't know about you, but I'd like to stay on one for a long time. Seriously, I mean, I don't, but you know, it's a zone of connection, and warmth, and comfort. But yes, please.
Yes, I know it's getting late, but just wondering about you talk about like love and conditioning.
Mm. Well, love is the way I perceive love. Love is ultimately unconditioned. And what unconditioned love is an unconditioned presence. Awareness is actually unconditioned love. That's what it is. Awareness is love. And this isn't the sensationalized love. And this isn't even the nature of love that people feel as a kind of unconditioned acceptance. It's beyond that. The only analogy that really works for that is space. The space in this room unconditionally allows everything in this room. It doesn't matter what happens in this room. You can blow this building up, and the space that this building's happening in is unconditionally allowing all of that. Unconditional love allowed Hitler. Unconditional love is allowing Syria, ISIS, Donald Trump, etc. Unconditional love is completely and utterly allowing of everything. It has no conditions. We human beings actually can and do experience unconditional love, and ultimately that's what we are. Nirvana, or liberation, full liberation, is unconditional love, permanently. It's not a state of consciousness. It's not conditioned. It's a liberation from all conditions. Then there's all these sort of, you could say, within that, and it is within that, all these other, you might say, not truly other, but apparently other forms of love that human beings experience. Compassion is a kind of love that approximates this unconditional love. Compassion is a spontaneous, heartfelt caring that arises in the face of suffering. And it spontaneously arises in human beings, and they act upon it at times. Like, if you look at the acts of compassion, beautiful acts of compassion, some of them never made it onto the news very much. You had to really look for them around the Orlando tragedy. It's beautiful, beautiful. Somebody did a montage of these photographs. I can't remember where I saw it the other day, but it was just like these incredibly beautiful photographs of people who were close to that, who were inside that nightclub, who were friends, you know, people holding one another. It was just remarkable. So beautiful. You know, and this happens to some extent on the planet quite often, where massive people will arise spontaneously, compassionately in relation to a tragedy. You know, and then Elie Wiesel dies the other day. Well, you know Elie Wiesel, the Holocaust survivor. And some, you know, neo-Nazi types, you know, they start celebrating. Oh, Elie Wiesel died. Yeah, great. This is completely and utterly insane. Unconditional love allows all that. Doesn't take sides. This is difficult for our minds to perceive, because if evil is something that happens in this realm, does unconditional love allow evil? I would say yes. Unconditional love doesn't disavow anything. And some people say that is what God is.
It reminds me of, like, when I've had those feelings of, like, experiencing myself as God and experiencing just what is beyond words, and that it's like the moment when the stories drop, when there is no more me, there is no more the conditions, and then it's like, that's indescribable.
Right. Well, you get a glimpse in there. There can be lots of subtle ways that glimpses happen, where you go beyond the story, you go beyond conditions. It happens every night in deep sleep to some extent. You miss it. I talked to this young girl who has she's 12. She has a lot of trauma, and she's a cutter. She's not doing it right now, thank goodness, but she's been a cutter at times in her life. And what cutters do is the psychic pain that they experience, they figure out a way to cut themselves to neutralize that pain temporarily. And it actually works. Problem is, it's very dangerous, it's not good, and you could cut yourself and die. It's a ritual that temporarily shifts the dynamic of psychic pain that they're experiencing. And this woman, young girl, she's really like a woman in many ways. She's very wise, in a very, very petite body. She doesn't sleep very well at all for a long time. So I asked her, how do you manage? Because most people, if you take away sleep enough, they just malfunction severely. It's like torturous. And she said, I learned how to put my body to sleep, and then I lucid dream. Now, when a 12-year-old says that to me, I slow down and I go, let's talk about this. First of all, who'd you learn from? She said, my brother taught me. And I said, what do you mean by lucid dreaming? And she said, lucid dreaming is when I put my body to sleep and then I can do whatever I want in my dream. And so I just said, okay, what do you like to do? She said, well, mostly I like to fly. I fly around. She said, but it takes a lot of, it's really hard work to make your body go to sleep. Because what she was actually doing was she's entering an altered state where she'd separate herself from her sleeping body, and then she would have mindfulness or awareness of the dream while she's dreaming. And that would give her, and it happens to anybody who does this, the sense of volition, yeah? Intentionality appears in the dream. In most dreams, for most people, they don't have intentionality. The dream just unfolds. And they might have a sense of intentionality, like I would like to say something to that person, but then it doesn't come out. See, so that's like on the edge of lucid dreaming. So even if you, and this is interesting, because one of the ways that I perceive this is that she has saved herself from much more difficulty that she would be experiencing if she didn't have this as a way to get rest. I don't know, will she be on medications? Who knows where she'd be? Because you can't go on and on and on without sleep. You gotta do something there. At least you gotta get this thing relaxed. You gotta get your brainwave frequency down some. Otherwise, you go crazy. Start getting all kinds of conditions and symptoms. There's a person who talks with all the hairs over one eye. Completely over one eye. Just looks at you like this. I asked her, do you have awareness that your hair is in your left eye? She said, no. She's completely unaware of that. And she pushed it back. I said, why don't you just push your hair back? She said, oh yeah. So it's like you've got a tremendous amount of awareness and connection in a certain area and disconnection in another area. What happens as we settle into our life as it is, and we start to feel that we not only maybe like our life, but love our life. Maybe fall in love with being alive. And there's a feeling of richness and okayness there, and it's not dependent on having certain things. It's the richness of being that's waking up, because the nature of our being is loving, fundamentally. So that compassion can arise, loving kindness, which is an energy that arises in humans, and it tends to go out towards others, where it's not so much in relation to suffering, but it's in a sense of wishing that everybody be well and happy. That's loving kindness. That's love as kindness. So it's love as compassion, love as kindness, it's love as respect, it's love as generosity, it's love as forgiveness. Yeah. A lot of different kind of shades or qualities or colors that love takes. There's love that sort of, I love you, you know, we come together, we partner, parenting, love. Friendship, like you say, well, I don't just like you, like I feel love for you. You can make that differentiation. You have two different words there. There's a felt sense inside of us of what that really is, that love is a multifaceted petal, flower, with all these parts. And at the core of that loving flower, or petals of the flower, is unconditional love. And so what we get to see is that the words themselves don't matter, ultimately. Awareness, unconditional love, nature of being, original nature, these are all just words, but they point to the same fundamental realization or truth. And the baby is that, but the baby doesn't realize that. And the gift of the human life and the gift of conditions is to see those conditions and to see through those conditions and to wake up to what you've always been and always will be. And that's both in time and not in time at the same time. It's time and it's timeless simultaneously. And that, interestingly enough, has many byproducts. Generally what it does, I see, is it frees people from good chunks of neurosis. It frees them from some of their core afflictions, like most people have core afflictions, like maybe fundamentally are restless. That's this. Okay. This is fundamentally at a defilement level, so to speak, restless. Ask my wife. She would say that's his affliction. Now, what's hers? Gotta be careful here. I'm gonna let her say that. What's that? But what happens is you Ramdas said it so well before his stroke shifted him enough so he couldn't say things so eloquently anymore. He said, you must become a connoisseur of your neurosis. So it's your teaching. And that's once you get a sense of that, it's very powerful. Like, I know that. It took me a long time to realize that what often drives me, neurotically speaking, is restlessness. Some people, strangely enough, are driven by doubt. Their life is organized by doubt. Or their life is organized by greed. I have a dear friend who passed away last year. He was only 65, but he passed away from liver cancer. He had cancer in the bloodline. His father, his grandfather had cancer. He's like, oh, I made it to 65. My dad only made it to 60. My grandfather only made it to 55. He's like, oh, if it's 65, okay. He was gone in 2 months with stage 4 liver cancer. His affliction was greed. Always wanted more. And if somebody else had a little better than him, he's jealous. He viewed the spiritual life that we shared as competitive. And he used to go, you are an idiot. It's not competitive. Not like that, but you know, a kid with him. He said, it's competitive. He said, you're going to get there before me. I said, stupid idiot. It's not like that. You can talk to him about these things, because what he believed in. He was very, very fixated on this. Somebody else is like doubting. Somebody else is like go through life and their core thing is aversion. Their core thing is actually fear. They might not know it, or they might know it. See, the teachings, the meditation, the yoga, the practices, if they work, give you access to how to work with these things. And not guess about it. Not be shopping. Is this the right thing for my conditions? You got to do some of that. But there needs to be a point where you settle. And that's why many teachers, and I encourage this too, will say, look, if you find a practice that really resonates with you, stop shopping. Line it up. Take it to the bank. Commit. Just like you want to get water out of the earth, one of my first Vipassana teachers used to say, you want to get water out of the earth, you don't drill a hole 10 feet. Oh, I don't like that hole. 15 feet. Right? 6 feet. You got to drill until you hit the water. That's an analogy for it. If you want to practice the work, you got to do it until you learn whether it really works, how it works, does it fit. You can't just keep trying things on. You can't keep shopping. There's a tremendous amount of spiritual shopping going on in this culture and other cultures too, but this culture is full of shopping, full of turning into entertainment. I'm not saying it isn't entertaining. That's just a byproduct. One of the most entertaining things in the world is to pay attention to your life as it is. You want a movie that costs nothing? Learn to sit still and observe. So thank you for that question. It's a very good question. I like your shirt too. It's nice.
Playing with the story.
This is too. My son plays not so much anymore. When he was younger, he played the clarinet, and so he was very good at it. And so he'd get these, you know, clarinetists and orchestra players who play wind instruments. The reed on the instrument is incredibly important. You know, so the reeds on the clarinet are called Van Doren. They're these French reeds, and you got to get a Van Doren just right reed. Otherwise, you throw it out, and you got to get another one. Throw it out, and get another one. So they always walk around with tons of reeds, you know, inside their cases. So thank you for coming tonight. We've gone just a little bit over. Thank you very much. Appreciate seeing you and your questions and commentary. Feel free to come again. We meet every Wednesday, unless it's a holiday.
You know, the only thing I wanted to comment on was I work in hospice, and I've started now to work on the other side where I'm actually working with people that are actively dying.
Yeah.
And it's amazing to me. Anna's one of my mentors, and it's amazing to me. I'm experiencing how people face death.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing people who are just so wrapped up in a story.
Yeah.
That they have like this, almost like a, like a delusion around their fear. Mm. That they're going into something else.
Mm.
But you can see the uncertainty. They're people that have like this real bargaining. They're not done. It's not complete. They're being cheated. And every once in a while, like today, you have these people who are just like, wow. You know, and I ask them, you know, you're so calm. You know, do you have a belief? No, not really. They're just on this journey. They're just completely immersed in that moment. Yeah, their body's breaking down. Yeah, it's a little discomfort. Don't know what's going to happen.
They're in the natural meditation.
It's really
phenomenal.
And it's an honor to be a part of that.
It is. It totally is. Totally is. And it takes one who's present and available, as the baby would, it takes you into that same space. You know, it's powerful to get close to that presence that's awakening, free from the story. It isn't a belief. That's a beautiful way you said that. It's not a belief.
And it's not staring into a child's eyes, but it's like staring into the abyss.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. Staring into that which can't be described. Because you look in human's eyes a lot of times, and if you look in human's eyes, you see this story. You see their consciousness is literally involved in the story. And if you just, like when I first started to meditate, seriously, at the end of these retreats that I would do, and sometimes 10 days was a common length, and you just be in silence for 10 days, and then you look in people's eyes at the end, and it's just spacious. It's just open. It's just the void. And then you'd watch the story come back in, if you actually look in your own eyes, I don't recommend you spend your time doing this, but if you want to, you just stand in the bathroom and look in your eyes for a while and let the story drop away. And look at what's looking out of your eyes and keep looking at that. Keep looking at that until you recognize that void, that open, empty, spacious, because that's where the love lives, beyond the story. So it's very fascinating. Yeah, I'm happy for you that that's open enough for you, that you have a chance to be in that. It's a great gift. Well, thank you for coming tonight. Good to see you.